Welcome to Line of Sight. My name is Don Heider. I'm the Executive Director of the Markulis Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University.
And I'm Thane Kreiner, Executive Director of Miller Center for Social Entrepreneurship at Santa Clara University.
We're really happy to have with us today on Line of Sight, Katika Roy. Katika is a gender economist and CEO and founder of the Denver-based Pipeline Equity, an award-winning software-as-a-service company that leverages artificial intelligence to identify and drive economic gains through gender equity. Pipeline launched the first gender equity app on Salesforce's AppExchange. As a former Fortune 500 global executive programmer and data scientist, Katika draws on this rich expertise to have built a company that in just over a year won 8 awards, including the AI Breakthrough Award. And she received a governor's proclamation, launched a social listening campaign that drew 18 million impressions in 2 months and quadrupled the sales pipeline. Katika is driven by a passion to eradicate economic inequality and champions the rights of refugees, women, and children. An award-winning business leader with more than 2 decades of experience in technology, healthcare, and financial services, Katika is credited as a rare combination of with expertise in and passion for gender equity, people analytics, and sales operations. Katika, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So talk a little bit about why you think gender equity is even more important given this time of COVID-19.
It's a good and important question. You may have seen that the B20, which actually advises the G20, so that meeting will be happening later this year, actually released a statement advocating that the G20 take into account gender equity in their economic recovery from COVID. And we knew that there were inequities before COVID. What COVID did was just bring it to the surface. And so from an economic perspective, we know that if we don't take into account the inequities, particularly around gender, as we think about the recovery, we will actually, there are a couple of things that will happen. One is that we will women and their families will bear the brunt of the economic crisis. And the second is that we'll stifle our economic recovery. If we really focus on things like gender equity and gender budgeting in terms of our fiscal stimulus, we'll actually be able to bounce back stronger and faster.
Talk a little bit about, you know, how you came up with the idea for the app and how exactly it works.
Yeah, absolutely. And we can also talk about what we're doing in terms of COVID-19, because we just launched a new product today that's specifically targeted toward gender equity during COVID-19. So Pipeline actually came from research, and we were really interested in, there's a lot of great macroeconomic research about the impact of gender equity on GDP, you know, mostly. So whether that's the World Economic Forum research, OECD, IMF, et cetera. We were really interested in how you drive that down to a microeconomic case. That is, what does that look like in terms of a company? And so we did a research study across 4,000 companies in 29 countries. We collected over 1 billion data points. And what we found was that for every 10% increase in gender equity toward parity, toward 50-50, there's a 1-2% increase in revenue. So that's the model that's actually implemented in our platform, which is gender equity is not only a social issue, it's also a massive economic opportunity. And CEOs are responsible for maximizing shareholder value. This is a very key lever that they can pull. That is gender equity. What Pipeline is augmented decision making. So much sort of in the pre-COVID days, you would use Waze or Google Maps to get from point A to point B. We do the very same thing for companies' human capital decisions. So what we are is a recommendations engine. We intercept HR decisions across the 5 pillars of talent, hiring, pay, performance, potential, and promotion, provide recommendations, and then track those actions over time.
So Katica, how does a company use pipelines to augment their decisions with data? Can you give us an example of what happens when someone is making a hiring decision to promote gender equity using?
Sure. So I'm going to pivot a little bit to pay, and then I'll talk what we're doing during COVID. So one of the things that's most often talked about is the gender pay gap. You know, Equal Pay Day was March 31st this year. And what we have actually found through our implementations is that you can't close the gender pay gap by starting with pay. Pay is the symptom of the problem. It's not the core problem. The core issue is that the value that we place on our talent in performance and potential then impact the quantitative value we place on our talent in pay. So, for instance, for performance, you would write a performance review, save it as a draft in your core HR platform. That sends a trigger to the pipeline platform that you need a recommendation. We pull that information through our platform, and then if we find any bias, we make a recommendation. And for performance reviews specifically, there are two things that we do. One is we use natural language processing to read through the performance reviews, call out bias phrases, and then we also calibrate the ratings themselves. So, for instance, successful, exceeds, et cetera. And one of the things that we found is that for similar performance on average, women receive lower performance ratings 4% of the time.
So can you talk a little bit about the natural language processing and the kind of biases that you're able to identify? And the reason I'm asking this question, having spent the last 10 years working in social entrepreneurship and talking to various CEOs and executive directors of social enterprises, is that I believe, and I love your views on this because I think you know a lot more about it than I do, that there's kind of a bias in the language that we use to talk about leadership qualities that is associated with typically masculine traits like power and things like that. But effective leadership, you know, coming back to the COVID-19 situation, there was a great article in Forbes about the countries that are responding best are all led by women. So is our framing one of the problems? And how do you sort of true up the natural language processing algorithms and pipeline to expose the bias? So some example there, and then there's some broader questions I threw in there for you to think about too, which is kind of my nature, right?
No, that's okay. And so what's interesting is there's a few things. We do tend to pattern match good leadership with male qualities, right? You're talking about power, and that what is interesting though is we have a different expectation about how women should behave. So if women exhibit those what are traditionally masculine traits like power, whatever, then she's not confident. She's bossy. Right. So you sort of walk this kind of this catch 22 or this double edged sword where you have to be confident and you have to be likable. Right. So leading then into what we find in terms of bias. Is what we often find for women is that their emotional state is what's commented on more than in their performance reviews, like how they showed up in a meeting. And there's sort of subtle words, like sometimes we see kind of like blatant, like she's bossy. Sometimes we'll see sort of the more subtle biases of, she didn't include people. There's just a lot more comments on the emotional nature of women, where when you look at male performance reviews, they tend to be very direct, very task oriented, very skill oriented. That's right. I was at a Wall Street Journal fireside chat in London last year, just about a year ago. And one of the things they asked me to do was to read two sample performance reviews and see if people could guess if it was female or male. And we just read, you know, performance reviews can be kind of long. So we read I read 2 to 3 sentences from each. And what was so funny was people knew as soon as you read it, people knew. And there was there was laughter because people knew because they had experienced it, that this is what that
or even done it. maybe unintentionally, because we have implicit biases. I might want to do this now to look at performance reviews I've written and see if I can tell whether each review is for a man or a woman, right? And I guess that a lot of this bias happens unintentionally.
Well, you know what's interesting about that is that what we found is for the companies that we work with, if they have, and Google is not a client, but just as an example, if they have a sort of name, like a common name that describes someone who works there, like a Googler, right? Or if for a Schwab, it's a Schwabby. One of the things that we found sort of interestingly enough, is that women are held accountable to emulating, to showing those characteristics of what a Schwabby or a Googler is, but men are not. Men can actually be promoted whether or not they're considered a Googler, whether or not they're, so this idea around culture, we tend to hold women to those ideals. That's what we found through our natural language processing. We tend not to, like men, it's great if they do it, but they don't generally experience any downside if they don't. So yes, we should change the framing, but this is also why it matters in terms of artificial intelligence and advanced technology, because you're absolutely right. Like all of us, so bias has a negative connotation because it can negatively impact groups of people, right? But fundamentally, if you sort of peel that back, my first master's degree was a combination of cognitive science and computer science. If you peel that back, that's actually how our brains work. Our brains create patterns, which are called schema, and we attach meaning to that schema, and then we take in new information, and that's essentially what bias is. So we talk about unconscious bias meet conscious action. This idea that most people are not most people are good-natured and they are intending to do well. There are a few bad apples, but they're not the norm, right? For using advanced technology, now you have scale and you've got a way to carry that through in an equitable manner, right? So one of the things we say to companies we work with is, we don't have a perspective on your pay philosophy or your ratings or anything. That's your decision. What we want to ensure is that those are applied equitably. Whatever that is, our job is to ensure it's applied equitably.
It is interesting, though, because, you would think that if you're evaluating folks, especially in management positions, you'd want both. You'd want to know how they're performing on task-oriented stuff, but you also want to know that they have emotional intelligence. And I think it's quite telling that we don't oftentimes organizations don't have good rubrics for which they're evaluating employees, or I think they're given short shrift. And I think the less guidance people have, the more those implicit biases can sneak in.
Yeah, or the cultural pieces. And I agree with you. We need to hold them accountable to both. Without our experiences, without advanced technology, it's very difficult to do that, right? Because we tend to sort of brush aside what maybe doesn't fit, right?
But it'd be great to have a tool that would help you see where some of your shortcomings are, yeah, as a manager, so you could start working on that,
Yeah, well, to some extent, that's what Pipeline does, right? It enables you to be equitable in your how you're evaluating your talent. What maybe doesn't fit, right? Yeah. Yeah, well, to some extent, that's what Pipeline does, right? It enables you to be equitable in your how you're evaluating your talent.
And really, one of the first steps to being an effective and authentic leader is self-awareness. So if the AI could provide awareness for actions, I think you're correct, Katika. Most people unintentionally may be building bias into the way they do performance reviews. And I think Dawn is also right that the first step is to help people become self-aware of the ways that they're evaluating people. Given that, can you talk a little bit more about how, once you build this knowledge into the review process, how do you actually create economic opportunity?
Yes. So the inputs to pay are performance and potential. So that is what your performance was this last year, and then where you sit in the succession to be a future leader in the organization. So those directly impact your pay, both, and it depends on the company, but generally that's in terms of your base pay, any sort of merit increase, as well as any type of target bonus payout. That's how performance and potential tie directly into pay.
So how do we see this actually leading to gender equity over time and translating to the economic opportunity?
So there's a couple things. There's the economic opportunity at the individual level. I mean, you may have seen while we've reduced the number of years overall to reach gender equity globally, we've actually added 55 years in the last year to global economic equity, which is equal pay as part of that. Opportunity is another part of that. So there are two pieces. For the individual, it's about their potential rating and actually being in the succession line for future leadership positions. But overall for the company, we actually keep track of what recommendations you've accepted. And then we tie that to what we call an economic gain number, which is really revenue. So how have you actually expanded the economic pie, if you will, of your company through moving toward gender equity? And just to give you an example, we mostly work with enterprise companies. We define those as companies that have 10,000 or more employees. For every 10,000 employees you have, there's three key decisions that you make across those employees, which is performance, potential, and pay every single year. For each set of 10,000 employees that you have, there's 30,000 opportunities for you to move toward gender equity each and every year. That's what we make possible. So we kind of take this intangible and make it tangible through the decisions that you're already making.
And as you're telling people about your app and working towards gender equity, what are some of the myths that you encounter and how do you debunk them?
There's a few of them. One of them is the pay myth, right? That is, you can't close the gender pay gap by starting with pay. That's one. So doing a pay equity study every year is not enough. The second is that gender equity is a social issue. It's not an economic opportunity. So getting them to understand that. And when you move it from a social issue to an economic opportunity, it also, when you look at the data is irrefutable. You can choose not to do something, but it is what it is. It also is about opportunity for everyone, which leads to the last myth, which is that it's often positioned as men versus women. Right? Gender equity is often defined as a synonym for women's rights, and it's not. Gender equity is 50% women, 50% men, and not just because men hold the majority of all leadership positions in large companies. It's because gender inequity impacts men too. We just don't talk about it.
How does gender inequity impact men? Let's talk about it since we're here.
Okay. So there's a couple, and one is directly in the workplace. One is sort of ancillary, but still connected to the workplace. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with COVID, but 48% of working dads would actually like to stay home with their children, but they don't. And the reason, there's two key reasons that they don't. One is identity and the other is isolation. So this identity, kind of what we raise our boys to believe about what it means to be a man in this world. And those are things that they learn through sports. It's things that they learn from the time they're very young. They learn that over time. The other is isolation. So if I'm going to stay home, who will I talk to? Like, I'm probably not going to go to the mom and me groups. I mean, my husband has been a stay-at-home dad for 12 years. Our oldest child is 13. When he first started staying home, he would take our son to music class. And he was not only the only dad in the room, he was the only man in the room. And, you know, the sort of feeling of not like you don't belong, you don't fit, right? So you know, that was something he grappled with and sort of wanting to do the right thing for our family, but feeling pretty isolated and kind of who am I besides taking care of children? So that's that piece. More broadly, we actually launched a voting guide. You know, obviously it's an election year. It's a presidential election year. We're nonpartisan, but we have launched this voting guide where we apply gender mainstreaming, which is essentially a gender lens to 15 campaign issues. And one of them is healthcare. And when you look at healthcare, specifically mental health is largely a men's issue. So it's not only do we not have adequate access to mental health care in the U.S. In addition to it not really being adequately covered or having adequate coverage, most therapists you would have to pay for out of pocket, and most families can't afford that. Separate from that, men account for 79% of all suicides in the United States. They are four times more likely to die from suicide than women. That's a mental health issue. It's a gender equity issue. We need to begin to address that. And it goes back to your sort of more subtle question around when we think about leadership and sort of the male pattern of leadership, bringing in sort of those, that emotional intelligence, that sort of softer side, that all ties together.
Right. So in other words, gender inequity stereotypes men and women and forces them into fulfilling roles that society expects of them, which may not be who they authentically are as leaders or even human beings. And by reaching a more equitable state with gender, then everybody in the ideal world could be the human that they are without conforming to different stereotypes of male or female.
Correct. Yeah, or masculine or feminine, right? And what we often talk about is the ability to step into a life the size of their dreams that we haven't given, that they can decide the life that they want.
Kafka, I'm curious about, I'm imagining that your app is being used by multinational corporations. I'm interested to think about what this means when you cross cultural lines, because you know how there's certainly bias across cultures, but there's also bias that's very particular to certain cultures. And so, have you had any experience with that that you could talk about?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in terms of it's a good point, because it would be different, for instance, if you like an implementation in Japan, right? That would be a very different implementation, or in some Middle Eastern countries, or even India, right? You would face it also takes into account natural language processing because that's contextual, right? You can't just translate what exists in the U.S. to what is in Japan. You have to actually, it's very contextual to understand what bias, like we know there's gender bias, but you have to understand what it looks like in each of those countries so that the natural language processing actually carries through and is valid. I mean, one of the things that we really focus on when we do implementations is to ensure that when you're receiving recommendations, that they match your environment. They're germane to your environment. They make sense. Anytime you're using augmented decision making, it has to almost seem like a human, but better. Right. And so understanding that context matters quite a bit.
So Kataka, building on Don's question, I can see, you know, it's really evident how there's different cultural constructs in different countries that might influence the gender equity to extents that Pipeline can't solve it on its own and with a natural language processing. But I'm wondering if you found any cultural differences within the United States. And you kind of alluded before to like the Googlers and, you know, the whole tech bro culture. And in Silicon Valley, I think we're all acutely aware that, you know, the venture capital firms, there's a tremendous, tremendous underrepresentation of women. And yet for at least 25 years or 30 years, the number of women coming out of business schools, Stanford, for example, which is a big feeder to the VCs, has been the same as the number of men. So what's going on with like the tech bro and VC culture that there's actually even less gender equity than I would imagine in some parts of the United States where people might assume that there's more bias?
I mean, it probably has to do a lot with pattern matching. But what's interesting about that is, you know, in the corporate world, on average, men hold about 68% of all leadership positions. So frontline manager up to CEO. But in venture, men are 91% of all venture firm partners. So the idea that I would be, and we're venture backed, when I pitch, there's very few times that there's a female in the room. And if she's a female, she's probably an associate. She's probably not a partner or a managing partner. So there is a fair amount of that bias that we're, or, you know, I would say undervaluing that we're seeing. And that actually is interesting in the time of COVID, because women last year, while they received the most amount of money from venture firms, so 3% of all venture dollars, they are little under 3%. They actually received less money than one company, which was WeWork. So as a cohort, all female founders receive less money than WeWork. So if you talk about the time of COVID, you know, where we are right now, venture-backed companies tend not to get any sort of help from the government, right? They did do it in the most recent CARES Act, but they tend not to do for multi-owner companies. They tend not to do that type of support. So you have really at risk at this moment a number of female-founded firms who just simply don't have enough cash to survive and weather the storm. And I think that's an interesting from a competition perspective in a capitalist society, is there an opportunity for the government in form of SBA grants to step in and create a more competitive marketplace in the time of COVID, really through the lens of an economic investment in our recovery?
What do you worry about most when it comes to gender equity in the future?
That we'll treat it as optional, that we'll make it only about women, that we'll still be having this conversation where men are the problem and women are the charity case, that we won't really look at it through data, that we won't really look at it through an economic opportunity. The other piece of it that really concerns me is we are at this moment, I know we're in the midst of COVID, but we're also in the midst of the fourth industrial revolution, this, you know, huge push toward advanced technology. And we really have a choice at this moment to either move toward embedding our biases into the future in advanced technology, or using that advanced technology to get rid of bias at scale. You know, it is because we're augmented decision making, we're making recommendations, you're ultimately making the decision about whether or not you're going to accept our recommendation. It is within our power at this moment to make gender equity a reality in our lifetime. That is completely possible. And so if you think about just the Fortune 500 alone, they employ millions and millions of people. If they implemented this, just those three decisions, right, you're talking about a huge catalyzing effect toward gender equity. So I worry that people make it too amorphous. They make it too us versus them. And they don't look at what's possible. There's a lot that's possible and that's within our grasp right now.
So can you talk a little bit, Katika, in addition to using Pipeline to help illuminate implicit, we'll assume, biases that managers might have in writing reviews and help address those three pillars that you talked about, what other things can companies, venture capitalists, other organizations do to close the gender equity gap?
Well, venture capitalists tend to ask, I get this question a lot, but they tend to ask, we'll start there and then we'll talk about companies. But for venture capitalists, they tend to ask female founders prevention questions. So how they're going to prevent the downside. What if you have an economic downturn like we have right now? What if, is the market really as big as you think it is? That's the question I get almost from every venture capital firm, but whatever it is, they're looking for downsides. Those are prevention questions. They're asking male founders about promotion questions. How big could you really make this market? What more could you do? Just think about Uber as an example, regardless of their history. Uber now has Uber Eats, right? So how big could this market actually get. And so one of the things for venture capitalists to be aware of is the questions that they're asking and how those questions actually are driving them to their decisions, right? So even though they make only, men make up 91% of all partners in venture capital firms, women receive just a little less than 3% of the dollars. Well, that's still a 4-point gap. Even if you look at the total number of female founders, which hovers around 15 to 17%, right? So understanding the questions you're asking and how you're judging people is something that venture capitalists can take into account right away. I think the other thing for venture capitalists as well as for companies is to understand that, so for venture in particular, their responsibility is to provide returns for their LPs. Right? LPs are the ones who make up the funds, right? And if that is their responsibility, those are essentially their shareholders, right? So much like a public company has shareholders, LPs operate very similarly in the venture world. If that's their responsibility, female founders actually have a proven track record of having higher returns for invested capital. They're actually a better bet. So I'm not saying you shouldn't fund men, but you should just look at it equitably and ensure, and that's not just the right thing to do, it's actually better for your LPs. I think it's to the tune of about $4 trillion in LP returns that are left on the table because of inequity. That's one piece. The same thing happens in companies, which is that if your responsibility as a manager, even if you're a frontline manager, even if you're not the CEO or the CIO, et cetera, is to, you have a responsibility, a fiduciary responsibility to that company. And so gender equity is a very key lever that you can pull to make that happen. It is about everybody's growth.
So here's a provocative question. So I've some of the statistics that you cited, in addition, I've heard that founding teams that have at least one female member far outperform all male teams. So would it make sense if VCs are really being responsible to their LPs if they would not even hear pitches from teams that are all men?
Potentially.
I mean, just to be provocative, to say, hey, we're not going to invest in you if you don't have women on your team.
Yeah, and then the question would be where? Like, what role is the woman? You know, because you don't want tokenism, right? We just brought her on because she's female, right? It's about making sure that the female women have a voice in the room, that it's that diversity of thought that then catalyzes better returns. So, a sort of number counting piece would be to say, yes, you know, we're not going to even look at you unless you have at least one female founder. But then second, what role is that person in? Like, how do they actually participate in the decisions that are being made?
Are they an essential part of the team?
That's right.
Because, you see a lot of people now saying, well, I will not participate on any all-male panels at a convention. And that's great. I think that's fine. But this would really have impact, a lot more impact than whether you're on a panel at a convention that's all male or all female or has gender equity. This would have serious impact in terms of who gets funding and who doesn't.
Right. Right. And then you could look at, Carta. We have Carta now. So if they have their cap tables in Carta, you can actually understand, Carta has done research on the equity gap, like in terms of what women versus men get. So you could actually understand that's actually another really key way to look at their cap table to see how much influence does this woman actually have in the decision making, right, of the company. It's interesting, the whole mantle thing, the all male panels, the mantles. I don't know if you saw this, but it's been trending on social media that they've resurged in the age of COVID. I don't know why that is. I don't know if it's because it's not in person and you can hide. I don't really know. But in any event, mantles have a resurgence during the age of COVID.
Which is absurd. And I'm not criticizing people who refuse to be on those panels because I think it's a good idea. But, I'd much rather see women make up 50% of boards than 50% of panels, honestly.
One of the things that we see is sort of these move towards solutions that look like you're doing something but aren't actually solving the problem, right? It's great if you're giving women visibility, but I'll just give you a quick example. Women make up about 51% of all entry-level roles in the workforce, right? But they're only 22% of the C-suite. We don't talk about what part of the C-suite they are, because they typically are not the CEO or the chief revenue officer or the COO. They are typically the head of HR and the head of marketing. And those are not often the positions that are going to be promoted into the CEO roles. So when we talk about that, we really need to talk about what roles are women in. These are things we actually look at. So we look at what roles are they in, what's their upward mobility. We look at quota carrying versus non-quota carrying. We look at span of control, right? So how many direct versus indirect resources do you control? All of those things matter a lot. It matters. It's not enough to just say, well, 50% of our leadership are women. Which 50%? And in what roles and what power do they actually have? That's what matters.
Because, again, you could make a big difference if you promoted women into those crucial roles. And obviously, just again, as you say, based on the statistics, between entry level and the C-suite, something's going horribly wrong. It's chronic and it's endemic and it's embedded in all these companies. And only a tool like yours and other concentrated efforts can make anything change.
Yeah, a couple of things. One is, when we designed Pipeline, so my first master's degree, my second master's degree was an MBA, but my first master's degree in sort of the cognitive science piece, behavioral economics, right? So it's easier to choose to do something than to not do something. So that's the way we actually designed the Pipeline platform, with this idea that it's about accepting recommendations rather than rejecting it, because it's unconscious bias meet conscious action. That's how we designed the platform. It's similar to, you may remember a few years back, they talked about 401k savings rates and they were too low. So what companies did was just auto-enroll employees into 401k as soon as they started a job. Well, lo and behold, the savings rates went up, because now I have to actually unenroll rather than to enroll. And so we designed the Pipeline platform that way as well, to really make it essentially not only the right thing to do, but also the easy thing to do. I just accept the recommendations. I'm good. I can actually move toward gender equity.
Wonderful. Well, it's really been a delight hearing from you, Katika, and I for one, greatly applaud your work, having sat in many meetings where a woman said something and 10 minutes later a male said the same thing and everyone attributed the idea to that person. And I said, wait, I heard Janet say that 10 minutes ago because I'm the project manager and I'm taking notes and I have it right here many years ago. But it seems like, as I said, many years ago, that pattern has not really changed all that much. And I'm hopeful that using technology, as you said, to really enable us to affect gender equity for both the benefit of men and women is really laudable work. So thank you very much for that.
Yeah, and I'd love to talk a little bit about what we're doing during COVID, because we just launched that this today. We focus all on internal talent. So even our hiring module is actually internal. It's not external. It's really about mobility. And because the best way to attract diverse talent is to ensure that your existing diverse talent is successful, and not just in their current role, but across your company. And so what we found on average is, for 86% of all job requisitions, we find 5 or more qualified internal candidates. Well, right, so what's happening, and companies often don't know who they have and what skills they have. So one of the things that is happening right now, particularly, it's happening to all companies, but particularly enterprise, is they don't know who in their company is going to be infected next with COVID. Regardless of the fact that we're bending the curve, they don't know. And most succession plans typically go 2 levels deep. It's the top 2 levels in an organization. So we actually pivoted our hiring module to a Pipeline Talent Finder module, It can actually be implemented in companies in 4 to 6 weeks. And that way, if you have somebody that is, you know, out with COVID, we can actually move people around at the push of a button and do it in an equitable way. So you're actually able to pivot your workforce on a dime or at the push of a button in an equitable way, so you don't have to choose between both.
That's excellent. What a great resource.
Yeah.
And so often we overlook talent, you know, and you hear people, you know, and people, I think people leave companies and go to other companies because they don't feel like they've had an opportunity. They feel like they're isolated in some way. They've been overlooked. And that costs money to retrain and hire new people constantly.
Yeah, at minimum, it's 3 months of their fully loaded compensation at minimum. And the higher up you go, the more it costs.
And I would just say, going back to the conversation earlier about stereotypes of what effective leadership is, that one of the talents that is often underappreciated is the emotional intelligence and ability for the team to work together effectively and find joy in that work, not just the hardcore results-driven approach that dissuades a lot of very talented people from staying in a particular position, whether they're men or women. So I think, you know, as we move towards gender equity, I am hopeful that we can have a broader definition of what leadership means in companies, in other organizations, and in the venture industry as well.
Yeah. Well, that growth mindset versus a scarcity mindset, right?
Thanks so much for being with us. It's been great having this conversation, hearing more about your app, and also how you all are dealing with the COVID crisis that we're all facing at this point.
Thank you. Yeah, we're really happy to be part of it and happy to move people toward catalyzing gender equity in the time of COVID.
Super. Well, thank you again for joining us for Line of Sight, a podcast from Markelis Center for Applied Ethics and Miller Center for Social Entrepreneurship at Santa Clara University. Our guest today was Katika Roy, leader of Pipeline and one of the drivers of gender equity around the world. Thank you, Katika.